I'm feeling cautiously optimistic about the...
I've spent my whole career working in hydrogen. I'm absolutely convinced that we...
That's where it needs to be. That's where the people actually...
People want to move forward. They have to have the courage to make decisions. And we start with improvements.
Thanks. I'm Shannon Souza. I'm an engineer and a water rights examiner. I practice mechanical and environmental engineering. I've had my own practice for 30 years, focusing on sustainability consulting and contracting. And I kind of divide my time equally in project development, community engagement, and policy reform, particularly for these newly emergent technologies that we need to see us into the future. I've been focusing on renewable energy and clean fuels for the last 20 of those years, and I'm feeling cautiously optimistic about the access that we have to the right technology at the right time. I'm feeling a little bit of anxiety about the sometimes polarizing political swings that we have and how they impact our work in these emergent spaces? Well, that's a great question. When the National Hydrogen Hub funding opportunity was announced in the Pacific Northwest, there was almost a singular focus on electrolytic hydrogen. So using renewable electricity to split the bond in water between the hydrogen and the oxygen. I'm thinking, gosh, we've got all of this hydroelectricity. It's already renewable. We have plenty of it. So let's stand up these massive hydrogen hubs throughout the Pacific Northwest. Once the rules, some of these policy implications came through from the Department of Internal Revenues and deemed that none of that legacy hydro would be able to be counted for that renewable component. But I think more important than that is once we got a better handle on just how scarce our electrons are becoming to support all of this work, the population growth we're seeing in the Pacific Northwest, the electrification of the transportation sector, and the decarbonization of our clean fuels, we've realized we don't have a lot of electrons to throw at electrolysis. So I think that that's been an important lesson for those of us working in the Pacific Northwest, is to keep an open mind. There are many routes to developing hydrogen. Whether that's through methane pyrolysis, whether we're talking about bio-based hydrogen, and yes, electrolysis. But the right solution is going to really depend on location, location, location. What's the community that you're serving? Do they have electricity available? Are electrolyzers priced low enough that if we're looking at some kind of an intermittent resource like solar, wind, new hydro, that is sufficient for these projects to pencil out? Or does it make more sense? Do they have natural gas available in this area with maybe a more scarcity of electricity? And the correct pathway to hydrogen is going to be pyrolysis. Or maybe they have a lot of biomass, and we should be looking at pyrolysis of the biomass for our hydrogen, syngas projects, things of that nature. So in the Pacific Northwest, it's been a really wild ride. There was so much focus only on electrolysis and on standing it up at this massive scale. So I think that there's been a reality check, and I think that we're right to be broadening the opportunities and our understanding of those opportunities, and to right size the project. Well, I think we've got a hybrid approach, if you will. Earlier in the conversation, David was talking about a transition that we're seeing from the broader regional grid and this reliance on imports of the various energy and fuel resources that we have, whether it's by pipeline for the molecules or for long distance transmission for renewable electrons. In both of those cases in the Pacific Northwest, we're constrained. If we want to bring more fuel into the Pacific Northwest, we need new pipelines or bigger pipelines. If we want to bring more renewable energy into Washington and Oregon from Wyoming, we need bigger we need bigger transmission lines. All of those things are in the works, but at the same time, we have these very real opportunities to look at the infrastructure that we already have in place, to look at the resources that we have readily available that aren't likely to be disrupted by a snowstorm or a wildfire because they're here in our backyards. So I really think that this is a combination. When you talk about how are we going to market that and develop the market, It really depends on where you are and what you need. We have a Western Resource Adequacy Program that's trying to start up and get on its feet for the entire Western United States and Canada. And we're having a heck of a time doing that because our utilities can't demonstrate that they can get access to the energy and the capacity reserves that they need to keep our lights on. So, do we need more transmission? Do we need bigger pipelines? Yes, and maybe would be my answer respectively there. But I think that this newer infrastructure, here's an example for hydrogen. Let's take Puget Sound Energy, right? They're in Washington State. They need to decarbonize and they need to serve an increasingly decarbonized transportation sector. So when Seattle Metro comes to them and says, well, we're going to electrify all of our vehicles. We need 20 megawatts of new electricity, new load. They say, so sorry, we can't deliver that to you in Seattle. So how about if we look at some other ways to electrify? Hydrogen comes to the top of the list and they start thinking about what can we do with the infrastructure and the resources that we have to decarbonize our public transit, and hydrogen is the answer. For more remote communities, many of which are in central and eastern parts of the Pacific Northwest, they're experiencing power and fuel delivery disruptions at alarming frequencies, whether it's from safety shutoffs or we're just losing the pressure in the gas pipelines due to really cold winter snaps. So that means that it's going to be more marketable. It should be a lower cost, lower risk solution to invest in these more modular, more reliable, more energy secure systems, whether it's local renewable energy or local clean fuels generation. Well, and so I don't think that we can do away with the larger projects. Absolutely. And we have to. And I think that at the beginning of your question, talking about the policy piece, again, I work equal time developing projects. And then when we run into a roadblock, and when it comes to microgrid, and when it comes to local fuels generation, the roadblock is often the policy. So then you have to roll there. And we haven't figured out how to update and modernize our public energy procurement model. This idea that it is always going to be less expensive for a 400 megawatt solar farm in Wyoming to supply your house in Bandon than a 20 megawatt facility that's right there in Coos County. And the reason is because they're not taking into account the additional cost of the build out of the transmission system between Wyoming and Bandon. We're not taking into account the additional cost of lost livelihood and lost lives when our electricity and our fuel supplies are disrupted. So those are two of the big pieces that we spend a lot of our time in the public utility space and in the legislative space trying to modernize so that we truly can identify what really is the least cost, least risk solution for this community. I think that the policy is going to follow public sentiment. And yes, we need to write our legislators, but I think that more importantly, we need to be having these discussions with the Sierra Clubs, with the Nature Conservancy, with the climate activists, with the environmentalists, who are really well-meaning and really do have this kind of an avatar vision of where we could be and can't we just be there tomorrow, to help them understand realistically where we are now, what are the options, and how do we weigh those options in a really honest, forthcoming way. I'm talking to you today from a biomass facility that generates electricity out of waste residuals from sawmills and from ladder fuels that we're taking out of the forest so that we don't have these mega fires. And half of my friends who are environmentalists are like, oh, biomass facilities, those are bad. They pollute. Those are yesterday. We need to shut them all down. They just don't know. Like, actually, no, we've got great pollution control and we're actually controlling wildfires. And this would all be going to a landfill and then released to the air. And hydrogen is the same. It's these pieces of the puzzle, growing trust, really figuring out what languages, what metrics are important for people to understand. How can we as a society weigh these options? The options are going to vary depending on geographically where you are and resource-wise, what's showing up in your backyard. So I really think that's where we need to focus. And podcasts like this are really helpful just to kind of increase the public awareness and improve the level setting for knowledge so that we can make informed decisions. When we sat down as this policy group of stakeholders that was brought together in 2020 to establish what became Oregon's clean energy goals, there was no plan. It was how much do you think we can decarbonize and by what date? And it was like a vote. Great. We have really aggressive goals. Washington has really aggressive goals. I'm not saying we should backpedal, but we established those goals without a plan. And so now we are trying to play catch up and explain to all of the stakeholders, those who had the most aggressive timelines for the most aggressive decarbonization, often are those who really don't have the broadest and deepest understanding of what it's going to take to get there. And there's so much distrust from this political pendulum swinging that we have. It, right? I'm enjoying in my practice two areas that are allowing me to take a more holistic approach, whether it's to a community or a tribe or a port district, ports being the economic development engines in the Pacific Northwest. And the two places are in climate adaptation and resilience planning. I see hydrogen showing up there. It's a unique tool that we can offer to our communities, to our tribes, for both the electricity and the transportation sides of the equation. I mentioned earlier the metro, the focus on decarbonizing our metro systems. And for a lot of our remote communities that are reliant on imports of all of their fuels, hydrogen fueling stations for metro are really attractive because they give them more energy security. And in the event that there's also an electricity outage, we're seeing a lot of focus and interest in taking those same buses that we're driving around and turning them into mobile resilience hubs. They've got fuel cells, they've got the ability to drive on over to the hospital, for example, and provide those services. The other area of my practice that I'm really excited about is in industrial symbiosis doesn't have to be just limited to industries and how they interrelate, but examining and optimizing those symbiotic relationships between industries, ecosystems, and the communities that they're located in. And increasingly, we're seeing, again, hydrogen show up as a really essential piece of the puzzle. A lot of our high-tech manufacturing for all of these amazing EV batteries that can charge faster and go farther, they use, guess what? Hydrogen in their manufacturing. We see that in the silicon cells for our solar systems. Hydrogen is indeed used in this high-tech manufacturing. In the past, it's been split off of the hydrocarbons. Now we've got an opportunity to look holistically about how we can integrate hydrogen into these industrial hubs that are clean energy hubs, resilience hubs, that also provide benefits to the local agriculture with access to green fertilizer for electricity, EV charging based on fuel cells, and for battery backup, fuel cell electricity backup. So lots of applications. We need all of the technologies. I love what you've built, David. I think that it will be critical for those people making decisions to be increasingly at a local level. We've had a real top down because that's how our energy infrastructure was built out necessarily 100 years ago. But it's a brave new world. So my hope, and I think that it's critical for this to occur, is that decision making, funding, intellectual capacity really starts to gel and grow at a more local level, whether it's a county or a port or a tribe. But that's where it needs to be. That's where the people actually are and where we need to learn to be able. Well, that's a great question. Capital likes certainty. It's not super crazy about speculation. So that I see that part of that comes back in the policy place. It's tough in the U.S. right now. Folks have lost confidence in us. So we're going to have to get really thoughtful about how we take the capital resources that, again, we have in our own communities, maybe strengthening our relationships with other communities around the globe that are more confident in and have a longer track record in these technologies. Japan and Denmark come to mind. Both of those are countries that are incredibly also fiscally responsible. So it's a nice opportunity that we have. And I know in the Pacific Northwest, we've got strong relationships with both of those. So maybe there's a combination of our homegrown circular economies reinvesting in ourselves. You know, one follow up, I mentioned Denmark, and I had the pleasure of joining one of the several, there have been several delegations from Oregon and Washington, specifically to look at industrial symbiosis and how they have decarbonized while upholding a 250% growth in their GDP. So definitely have not undermined their economy in the process by any means. And what they used as a tool was, even though they have 11 political parties, somehow they were able to come to consensus that they needed to decarbonize and not turn back. And they have aggressive decarbonization goals. They have really high carbon taxes for industry that's not able to make them. But that very same industry has access to all of those funds to invest in their decarbonization. I know it's politically uncomfortable and unpopular, and Oregon has not been able to get into the carbon market. boy, does it work if we provide people with the opportunity to either continue with the old way of doing business and pay more to do so, or to access those very same funds that those who aren't adapting use those funds to decarbonize ourselves and in the process really increase our energy. I'm feeling good. I expressed that I'm used to operating in my 30 years of practice. I've always been on kind of that leading edge, and unfortunately sometimes there's a little blood. So that of course brings some anxiety to the backdrop, but that's where we're at. And specifically in the Pacific Northwest, we're pioneers. That's our culture. And so I am very optimistic by the folks on this call and that we're having this conversation and how powerful it is when we can connect with each other and share thoughts, wins, losses, what our observations are, and how we can better take care of ourselves, how we can better take care of each other, and really help to make this a successful transition. Hopefully there will be more podcasts like this on more topics so that we can reduce some of that distrust that we were talking about earlier that unfortunately gets in the way of progress.
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm Dave Edlund. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Element One. My background is in chemistry and chemical engineering, and I've been working in the hydrogen space for close to 40 years now, really all of my professional career. I'm incredibly optimistic about the future of this technology and the industry. I've been at it long enough to know when simple feasibility demonstrations in the laboratory were big news, and that's long behind us. We have many companies globally who are well into commercial deployments of hydrogen technology, whether that be fuel cells, hydrogen combustion engines, what we do at Element One, which is making hydrogen from a readily available feedstock. And it's really the private sector that is driving that forward. Support from government is important and it's there, but that's not the sole driving force here by any means. What do I want to get out of this conversation? I want to share what we're doing. I want to share what's happening in this space so that everyone can learn about it and understand the change that we're going through, both in North America and throughout the globe, as we look at how electricity is made, how vehicles are going to move. It's a very great idea. Love it. No, you're right. And you know, this is an opportunity that we've been aware of and have been pursuing for some time. I totally agree with what Shan has been sharing here. I am a huge, huge fan of distributed generation, or microgrids, as we like to call them, rather than centralized production and long-distance interstate transmission of electricity. I think a very good analogy to look at here is telecommunications, right? When I was a kid, if you wanted to speak on a phone, that phone had to be wired by copper into a network. Had to. There was absolutely no other option. Just think about the difficulty of that, right? And now that's ancient history. My kids don't even know what that was like. Why do the same with electricity? Why have centralized generation, long distance transmission, all of the cost, as Shannon pointed out, that goes with that, not to mention the time delays. How long does it realistically take to get permitting approvals for an interstate transmission line? How about an intrastate just from one county to another? It can be decades. We hear of opportunities in California, Washington, of, yeah, the grid can't supply the number of megawatts that the customer wants. We'll put you on a waiting list. It might be 6 years before we get to you, but we'll put you on the waiting list. Well, you know, there's a term here that we talk about. We use it so much, we meaning us in this community, we probably don't think about it. And that word is transition. This is an energy transition. And too often, we end up in conversations with potential early adopters who want all or nothing. You know, they want to go from where we are today to 100% renewable, low carbon intensity, cost effective, low footprint, long lifetime solutions on the first order. We have to transition. It's a continuum. And we start with, well, I feel very, very optimistic. Nothing I've heard in this call has changed that. It's been enlightening to hear the variety of potential users of hydrogen, the applications for hydrogen that Shannon is dealing with. That it just underscores in my mind the size of what we call the total addressable market. And it's not just limited to the Northwest, not limited just to the U.S., it's global. All of the challenges we have here are experienced by people in every country. Sadly, in many cases, people have a lot more challenges with energy than we do here. So it's very encouraging to hear the breadth and the variety that Shannon is dealing with. I'm very optimistic. I think, as I said before, we've passed the tipping point. We're on our way to hydrogen as being a major part of our energy solutions going forward.